Welcome to Weed Week. I'm Alex Hopperin.
And I'm Donnell Alexander. This is the Weed Week podcast. You can subscribe to our free newsletters, Weed Week California, and Weed Week Canada at weedweek.net. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Weed Week News. Got any feedback? Write us via hello at weedweek.net.
We should also mention Patreon, right?
Oh my God, yeah, we've got this Patreon campaign with amazing rewards for all of our really loyal followers, people who we're really glad to have in the mix.
For $2 a month, you get extra podcast episodes and some stickers, and then at higher levels, you get more swag, and at $25 a month, you get the really cool auto joint grinder and joint filler, this really cool machine.
And starting at $100, you can promote your brand.
In our newsletter and maybe even in the podcast. So today our guest is Steve D'Angelo, who...
possibly our biggest name on here. We've had Mike Tyson, but I'm thinking about in terms of cultural reference and influence. Steve D'Angelo might end up being one of those dudes.
Yeah, and I mean, he's sometimes known as the godfather of the legal weed industry.
Oh...
what was that? An attempt at the Godfather music?
No, that was sort of an because he's kind of we're making him a supernatural figure, are we not?
Yeah, he's a pretty interesting guy. But first, there's a murder in L.A. this week that's been getting a lot of attention, or a rapper named Nipsey Hussle.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting about it, it's not just another dead rapper. A rapper died last spring, and my kid said, this is our Kurt Cobain. And I said, no, it's not, actually. You know, what Nipsey Hussle did is, it's better than Tupac in terms of what he did. Tupac was kind of a pop culture icon that had a lot of music industry behind him. And what we had with Nipsey Hussle was kind of an outlaw. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about on this podcast because, you know, as we talk about Steve D'Angelo and his relationship to the industry, you see that there are people from the illicit side not that far away. And, you know, that's where Nipsey Hussle comes from. He came from the streets of selling illicit drugs, but he was an outlaw and that he wouldn't sign with the major label. He was someone who was intent on doing it on his own. I had an interaction with him, you know, not an interaction, but a real full-fledged collaboration. He helped me with the thing I did for a conference on capitalism at Cornell a few years ago. And he had just done this thing called the $100 mixtape, where he literally bet on himself. He said these mixtapes, which at the time were free, you know, I'm going to sell one for $100, and on the strength of people being fans of me, I'm going to make some money. Well, I think the first 100 Jay-Z bought, and that sort of got him going, and he became this icon of independence. You know, went back to his neighborhood and did important things until he saw that you can't always go back to the neighborhood. Very much beloved in the community.
And he was a businessman, too.
Yeah, that's what the $100 mixtape was about. And, you know, he talked to me at this conference on capitalism. We did a piece, which we could probably link to on the website. We talked about the evolution of mixtapes and hip-hop as a entry-level place where you can do all kinds of things, the kind of place the drug dealing game used to be, and maybe it still is. But he did this thing that I thought was super amazing that set him apart, because I talked to all kinds of rappers and famous people. But, you know, I told him it would be really cool if I did this PowerPoint presentation, if he could call in and we could talk live and expand on our interview. And he was going to be on a plane. He was on American Airlines. And he tried to hook it up with me so that we could make this phone call and he could be present in the interview. And I can't think of any rapper I've dealt with of any sort of import or cachet who would have made that effort or appreciate how important it was to be there. So he was a special kind of dude, just a unique character.
It sounds like it. I mean, I didn't know who he was, but he clearly meant a lot.
Yeah, I was at the gym and there were kids playing it in the locker room. I thought that was fine. Then they were playing it in the sauna. I'm like, dude, he's an icon, but, you know, we got a shower. Speaking of a hustler, you've got a different kind of hustler, someone who's come from a different part of the illicit industry into the mainstream, right?
Yeah, well, Steve D'Angelo, our guest today, you know, I think as much as anybody in the cannabis world, I mean, he really straddles sort of this divide between sort of the activist past and the capitalist present. You know, you'll hear in the interview that he really, as Hannah, our producer, said, he really can sound like a Republican. But he also is a very articulate spokesman for what he sometimes calls a new kind of industry, meaning that cannabis people can get rich off it, but it can also be an industry that respects the environment and pays its workers decently and treats them well. And tries to atone for the war on drugs. And he's been criticized sometimes for not necessarily living up to this all the time. And, you know, I think probably some of that criticism is fair.
So how would you contrast him with an actual Republican, say John Boehner, who's become involved in cannabis?
Yeah, well, I think it's a pretty good comparison. John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, he recently said he just never even thought about the criminal justice aspect of cannabis. And while he was in office, he said he was unalterably opposed to legalization. But now that he's out of office, he's been granted well over $10 million in stock. $10 million.
By who?
This company, Acreage Holdings, and they're one of the big...
Oh, right, right.
So they're one of the biggest multi-state operators. And at South by Southwest recently, their CEO, a guy named Kevin Murphy, called Boehner courageous, for changing his mind on cannabis. Of course, didn't mention that he had received huge amounts of stock.
Slight omission.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it's worth just saying that with Steve D'Angelo, you have a guy who's a real visionary and pioneer. And has he always lived up to what other people's ideals of what he should be? Perhaps not. But with somebody like Boehner, you have a very different portrait of what the industry could be. So as somebody on the board of this big company, you know, for his time in Congress, Boehner was singularly focused on deregulating business so that it could pollute more and pay people less and discriminate against people. And, you know, he opposed a rule that would stop discrimination based on sexual orientation. He opposed rules that would help women get paid as much as men. And, you know, this paints an industry of, or a picture of the future of the cannabis industry as, I would say, a very... not a new kind of industry. I would say an old kind of industry.
Right. And I think that's part of an ongoing discussion about what kind of industry we're a part of now. So you're not saying that Steve D'Angelo is like John Boehner, are you?
No, I'm saying they're totally different. One is a pioneer, and Steve Jobs gets criticized a lot too. Boehner is just a parasite, basically, getting paid to not even using cannabis. So anyway, given the choice, I'll buy from Steve anytime.
The Steve Jobs of cannabis. Steve D'Angelo, right here, right now.
Steve D'Angelo, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I guess one of the big stories with Harborside is that you guys seem to be doing really well, and while so much of the California market is struggling, what's your secret?
Well, you know, we are managing through what is a very challenging transition in California, and one of the reasons that we've been able to do that with more success than some other folks is that we've always had a forward-looking strategy. And we understood that a few things were going to happen with the transition to legal adult use cannabis in 2018. And one of them was that the supply chain would be severely disrupted. So we've maintained control of our supply chain, and that's been one of the secrets to managing through this period of time.
You just made one of the biggest deals in history, the history of legal marijuana. And I'm curious to know if you can explain to Weed Week listeners how this reverse takeover worked.
Yeah, so essentially, you know, the background for this is that because the federal government of the United States still has their head in the sand about cannabis, the United States public stock exchanges are not open to United States cannabis companies. It's kind of crazy because Canadian companies that are equally cannabis companies are listed on the Canadian public exchanges.
And the American ones.
That seems to be okay. So what that has left companies like Harborside, who are United States cannabis companies with United States assets, really with only one route to the public markets, to the public stock exchanges, and that's through Canada. And in order to be listed on the Canadian stock exchanges, you need to be a Canadian company. So the way that we did that was we merged with a much smaller Canadian company called Lineage. and they had some existing cannabis assets, but much smaller number of assets than we did. And so when we merged with them, we retained control over the merged corporation. We brought their assets into the combined entity. And because Lineage was already a publicly traded stock on the Canadian Stock Exchange, we now will, once the Canadian Stock Exchange approves our listing, which they're in the process of doing, we will then be listed on the Canadian Stock Exchange.
A lot of companies are doing this. Why did it make sense for you? Just for capital raising or for what?
Well, because the right now, if you take a look at the cannabis capital markets, it's difficult to raise the amount of money that we need for our expansion plans without at least a pathway to the public markets. One of the things that cannabis investors are looking for increasingly is liquidity. For many, many years, the only investment route that cannabis investors had open to them was to buy equity in a private company. And the problem with that is that sometimes those companies do very well and they throw off money to the shareholders. Sometimes they do okay and there's not that much money to throw off. Sometimes even if they do well, a decision is made to reinvest those funds into the company rather than to pay the early investors. So you can invest in a company and your investment can be stuck there for a long time and it can be difficult to pull it out. And that's been the experience of many cannabis investors over the course of the last decade or so. So they are hungry for liquidity. The market is hungry for liquidity. When investors invest in cannabis, they want to know what your exit plan is, and they want to know when they think they can get paid. So this is why we chose to go to the public markets, because it is what investors have been telling us they're most interested in doing.
Can you walk our listeners through your past as an activist?
Sure. And what you're talking about is...
I know it's a long story. Maybe we're not going to be walking. We might have to run through it, but you know what I mean.
I will sprint through it. How about that? The short story is that I've dedicated my entire life to spreading this plant, the cannabis plant, and the knowledge that I believe this plant teaches as far and as wide as I can, with the object of one day making sure that everybody on this planet who can benefit from a cannabis plant, and I believe that's every human being, because we all have endocannabinoid systems, that all of us have safe and affordable access to the cannabis plant. In the first part of my career, it was purely activist work, putting on demonstrations, collecting petitions, running initiatives, hemp tours.
When you say you've been doing it in your past, you're talking about decades of work, just to be clear, because, you know, I want people to know.
Yeah, let me be clear here. You're talking to a 60-year-old man who put on his first cannabis demonstration at age 15. So I have about four and a half decades into it at this stage of the game. And after that initial stage of pure activism, I moved on to really develop a niche in social entrepreneurship, in creating legal cannabis companies that also gave me a platform to carry that message. The first of those was an industrial hemp company called Ecolution, which basically I started in 1990 and sold in 2000 to come out to California, where in rapid succession, I started three very pioneering cannabis companies. The first was the first gold standard retail dispensary, Harborside, which was one of the first six cannabis businesses licensed in the United States. The second was Steep Hill Laboratory, which was the first cannabis analytical laboratory. And the third was the ArcView Group, which was the first cannabis investment company. So in later years, my activism has been more through business vehicles. But along the way, I was targeted by the federal government because of my activities largely at Harborside. And so I've also been the subject of a lot of high-profile litigation with the federal government, which we, for the most part, have won. So I come to the table with this very strange combination of deep legacy cannabis culture and also really being one of the people who arguably deserves the most credit or blame, depending on how you look at it, for making cannabis fully legal and bringing the corporate world into the world of cannabis.
That work that you're talking about doing as an activist, how is that informing the work that you're doing now? You use the phrase activism in the business or something like that.
Yeah, well, it informs my work in several ways. You know, we have always, Harborside and every organization I'm a part of has always seen a critical part of our mission to be legalizing cannabis and telling the truth about cannabis and taking every opportunity to do that. But the mission changes and shifts as the trajectory of cannabis reform shifts. You know, when we first opened Harborside in 2006, it was at a time when the federal government was still raiding cannabis dispensaries, and medical cannabis was far from being an established, mostly legal thing. And so the mission then was very simple, right? Just to make sure that we set a very good example of what medical cannabis looked like, so that the little island of reform we had staked out in California, which at that time was the only medical cannabis state, the only legal cannabis state of any kind anywhere, that we showed a good example to the world. And that was why we created this gold standard model of Harborside, so that Oakland wasn't the first and the last city to license cannabis, so that other cities would be happy to jump in. Then once we had that established, we moved into 2008 and 2009, and the Obama administration had just gotten elected on a promise to stop the raids of dispensaries. And so, you know, Troy, my partner at the Archery Group, and I being students of American history, understood that what came after Obama was likely to be more hostile to cannabis rather than more friendly, and we were right in that. And we felt that it was incumbent upon us to do something to make sure that the ball of reform got rolled so far down the field that nobody could roll it back, no matter who the next administration was. And we decided that the best way to accomplish that was basically to invite the corporate world into the world of cannabis, to bring the investor class into the dynamic, and to create a profitable, legal, politically engaged cannabis industry.
So is what it looks like now commensurate with your vision from 10 years ago, or how is it different?
Well, you know, what we're seeing right now, both in California and I think in other places around the country and around the world, is a dynamic for me, which is at once gratifying and painful. Sometimes I feel like the old Western mountain man, and I'm sitting on top of a mountain and I'm looking down at a valley with a town below, and it looks like the promised land to me, like we've really accomplished everything that we set out to do. And there's other times that I look down and I see a noisy, crowded town full of a bunch of people I really don't want to live with.
What does that mean? I have to stop you on that. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, what it means is this, right? You know, I grew up and still feel a lot of kinship with legacy cannabis culture. And to me, that culture was built by people who have a personal relationship with the cannabis plant of some kind. It means something to them. Largely what we're seeing now with the new cannabis industry is an influx of folks from mainstream business who really relate to cannabis mainly as a money-making opportunity, sometimes exclusively as a money-making opportunity. We have some cannabis CEOs of major companies who proudly announce that they never have and never will consume cannabis. So what we're seeing is that many of the people, John Boehner, a very good example, right? To this day, he won't consume cannabis, but he's happy to make money off of it. So what we're seeing is that a lot of the legacy cannabis people who grew up in a gray market or an underground economy didn't have the opportunity to develop skills like finance, because if we kept financial records, they would be seized and used as evidence, or marketing, because if we made it clear where the cannabis was coming from, the feds would follow us back to the source and bust us. And this was true up until just before, you know, as late as 2017 in the state of California. So the legacy cannabis companies lack many of the skills that are necessary to be successful in the new regulated market, including capital acquisition. On the other hand, you have a lot of folks who are coming in from mainstream business who have those skills in abundance, who have an ability to raise many millions of dollars, and they're beginning to deploy those skills and those capital and are competing against the legacy cannabis companies. And in many cases, what we see is that the legacy cannabis companies are beginning to feel a lot of pressure, and in some cases are dropping out of the market.
I mean, is feeling a lot of pressure a little bit of an understatement? Because you must know peers who are drowning, right? People from back in the day, I mean.
Yeah, look, I mean, it is tragic. What's happening in many parts of the Emerald Triangle is tragic. There are families who have had to bring their kids home from college because they can't pay tuition. There are families who no longer can pay the mortgage on their family farms that they've lived for three generations. There are places where 50% of the storefronts are empty now. There is devastation.
Yeah, I've heard it described as a mental health crisis.
Well, yeah.
So that, I guess I get back to that question, because it's the best of times for you, correct? But it must feel like you've left the hood or something. What is it like for you right now?
It doesn't feel like I've left the hood, because I still spend an awful lot of time and an awful lot of energy advocating on behalf of this plant and behalf of the cannabis community. So I don't feel in any way that I've become disconnected with my roots, but I feel a lot of mixed feelings, right? On the one hand, you know, my main allegiance in the world, my main mission in life is making sure everybody who needs this plant gets it. And I don't think that we accomplish that goal without engaging the same mechanisms of global commerce that produce and distribute every other good. So I am happy to see the corporate world in here. When I see corporations that otherwise would be selling tobacco or alcohol or pharmaceutical products instead selling cannabis, I view that as a huge victory. At the same time, my friends, my dear ones, the people whose children I've held in my arms as babies, who love this plant more than many of the people who are now making fortunes off of it, are suffering. And I'm suffering along with them. I feel that pain. So it's this very strange set of mixed feelings that I'm carrying with me these days.
So what would you like to see happen to the market now to sort of strike some sort of a balance, assuming that that's part of your objective?
You know, in my ideal kumbaya world, there's a few things that happen to the current situation. First of all, some of the barriers to entry that currently exist for small and legacy cannabis producers and manufacturers would be lowered. Right now, the requirements for people who want to create small, low-level cannabis businesses are so demanding that they can't raise the capital that they need to get into the game. And so some of those requirements need to be made less demanding. Right now, cannabis in California is the most strictly regulated substance in the state. It is regulated more strictly than radioactive waste. It's not a dangerous substance. It is a wellness product, and it should be regulated that way. And so there's a lot of artificial barriers to entry that have been created for the legacy cannabis community, and those barriers should be reduced, number one. Number two, I'd like to see a recognition amongst the new mainstream business players who are coming in that the pool of legacy cannabis business people represent, you know, their most available pool of subject matter expertise. And I've frequently seen a level of arrogance from mainstream business people who come into the cannabis industry that's shocking, that I don't think they would carry if they went into any other new industry. If you go into any new industry, you're an investor, you're starting a new company, generally what you do is you go to people in that industry who understand the industry, you seek them out, and you bring them onto your team and you learn from them. And I've seen an awful lot of the new mainstream companies come in with a lot of assets and deploy them in ways that aren't often the smartest ways, and they could have benefited from learning from some of the legacy talent that's out there. So on the other hand, I think, you know, that a lot of the legacy folks, you know, are sometimes have a level of unwillingness to engage with that mainstream business world. So in my kumbaya world, the straight mainstream business executives smoke more joints and have more respect for the legacy cannabis community. And the legacy cannabis community understands that if we really want this plant that we love to claim her and fulfill her full destiny, then we need to share her with everybody, even the mainstream business world.
You might need to put on some workshops for these people in the mainstream business world. Do you acclimate them? Is that something that happens with ArcView and such?
Yeah, look, there's a big process of acclimation that needs to go on. The cannabis community and the mainstream business community have been cleaved apart by prohibition. And there's a wall of misunderstanding and mistrust that needs to be broken down. So one reason that Troy and I founded ArtView was that we had, on the one hand, we had cannabis entrepreneurs who were coming to us who had good businesses and were looking for growth capital. But they didn't really have a clue about where to find investors, how to talk to investors, how to put together a pitch deck, anything, right? How to structure investment terms. And on the other hand, we were being approached by investors. Mainly, they were people who were philanthropists who were donating to the cause. And they wanted to find deals, but they didn't know how to get in touch with the deal flow. They didn't know how to evaluate the teams or manage the risk or understand the competitive forces in the marketplace or the trend lines. So that's why we created the ArtView group to bring these communities together to learn from each other and to empower each other.
So the ArtView group, for listeners who don't know, is a sort of networking company where cannabis companies can be connected with investors. And it's one of the biggest ones out there. You've raised, I think last I saw, looked on the website, it was companies had raised more than $175 million through ArtView, and it was a comparable number of companies, so average deals of about $1 million each. That may not be exactly right.
Yeah, it's in that neighborhood. Last time I checked, my recall is about something north of $200 million to something north of 160 different companies. And what that reflects is that we started life as an angel investor network. At that time, the only kind of cannabis companies there were startups. And many of the companies that you read about now, like MedMen and Ease, got their starting seed money out of the ArtView group. And we have grown over the years to become one of the top 10 angel investor networks in the United States. And the niche that we have filled really has sort of evolved over time. We now not only just fund startup companies, but companies that have done well and grown, then come back to the ArtView group for later stages of investment. We've also created our own venture fund within the ArtView group and partnered with an accelerator group, the Canopy Accelerator Group. So the business model sort of evolved as the markets evolved.
I've wanted to ask you about social equity. When you look at what California's gone through in the effort to try to establish this paradigm, do you feel like it's had to take one for the team for the rest of the country? Because that's how I kind of look at this uneven opening. Or is it something that's just a mess? Where are you coming from on this?
Oh, no, I look at it a bit differently. You know, I think that California is the laboratory of the future. We pioneer things in California that the rest of the country then adopts. Think about personal computers, think about yoga, think about organic food, think about cannabis. I think that that's what's going on with social equity. We are becoming a more diverse country. And as we become a more diverse country, as we become a more informed country, people come to understand that diversity, it needs to be a basic building block of every single thing that we do.
I get that, Steve. That's not the question I'm asking. I'm asking about the rollout and the sort of expectations among people from these communities that they would be able to take part immediately, and they sort of have had their hopes maybe undermined. I know everyone's been screwed by the rollout in the state, but these people are from communities that are especially vulnerable, and I wonder if you had specific thoughts on how they've been impacted.
Yeah, sure. Look, the first time that we do anything, it's usually a mess, and the regulation of cannabis has been no exception in California, right? It's part of that pioneering role and doing things that nobody's ever done before. So I think that, you know, I'm most familiar with what happened with the equity program in Oakland. I'm somewhat familiar with what's going on in Los Angeles right now. And I think that there have been a lot of things that have not worked well. So to get specific, you know, in the city of Oakland, there was a pairing process between equity applicants and general licensing applicants. And that pairing was done in a kind of haphazard, not very well thought out way, so that at various different stages of the process, either equity applicants got tremendously backlogged, or general license applicants got tremendously backlogged. And between those two backlogs, what happened was that the permitting process in Oakland was so slow relative to cities like West Sacramento and Santa Rosa that the large cannabis companies that would have otherwise located in Oakland, many were located in Oakland, left and went to other cities. So the equity program in Oakland had this kind of perverse result, right, where instead of creating more opportunity, it sort of choked the level of opportunity down because the permitting process was so slow. It was just impossible to get permitted for businesses. And then other companies that would have come to Oakland that did not come to Oakland at all because they had heard about the problems with the licensing. So the result was to create less opportunity rather than more opportunity. The intentions were good. The result was not so good. And that's what happens sometimes when you do things for the first time, you know. Think about the first time you drove a car or the first time you had sex. Sometimes things don't work out the first time so well.
Well, the first time I had sex, it was pretty amazing. But no, but seriously, but as a result, these communities that suffered the most during the war on drugs, they're not getting to benefit. If you miss the boat in Oakland, maybe there's a chance to make it up in another city. But so far, I mean, it's really not working that well. Like, is there a way to make it work better?
Yeah, I think there is, right? And I think that the answer for that is for us to see private actors step up who have an ability to do things that government regulations are never really going to work to do. So one of the things that I would like to see and that I have been talking about with people in the industry and will continue to talk about in the industry and would be happy to participate in one day is a dedicated fund for entrepreneurs, for cannabis entrepreneurs from communities of color. The investment proposition on that fund would be, Mr. Investor, Ms. Investor, you understand going into this that you are going to get below market returns on this investment from a financial point of view, but you are going to get much more valuable returns by making the world a better place. And we will use those generous terms that you give us to make capital available on terms that will allow entrepreneurs of color not just to have access to capital, but to get that access to capital in such a way that they may have a little bit of a competitive edge.
So we only have time for one more question, but you told me about a very similar idea to this in 2016, and it still hasn't happened. I mean, is there any progress? I mean, when can we expect it to reach fruition?
I can't tell you when it will reach fruition. You know, what I do is I'm a visionary. I talk about ideas. I try to rally people behind ideas. Sometimes it takes a long time to make change. You know, I started working to legalize cannabis. I did my first actions in 1974. And it took until 2018 for the state of California to make cannabis legal for all adults. So the arc of change and justice, right, is long sometimes. But that doesn't mean that we don't start talking about it and start pushing forward. And, you know, what I can tell you is that, you know, I continue to talk about these things and do what I do, which is advance visions. And I'll keep on doing that until either people stop listening to me or we achieve them.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, really excellent speaking with you. Thanks a lot.
Likewise. Anytime. Call me back.
That's our show for today. As always, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Weed Week News or email us at hello@weedweek.net.
But hold up. This time we're going to do something different. We have stickers. We have Weed Week stickers for people who will actually write in to deal with this question. And it's a very good question this time. Why don't you let her rip?
Write to us at hello@weedweek.net. Tell us about when you met Steve D'Angelo.
Or if you just want the stickers and you don't know Steve D'Angelo and never met him, you could write in with your experience at the Harborside store. Do you approve of stores that big? I'm curious about that. If you like Steve D'Angelo, write in. But if you have a Harborside story, we'd like to hear that too.
All right. Don't forget to show us some love on iTunes by giving us a rating or leaving a review. It means a lot to the show. And for lots more Weed News, you can sign up for our Weed Week newsletter, Weed Week Canada, and Weed Week California, all at weedweek.com. Dot net, and you can give us some money on Patreon and we'll get you some swag and cool gifts. I'm Alex Halpern.
And I'm Donnell Alexander.
Our producers Hannah Smith and Alicia Beyer wrote our theme music. Additional music is from the late great Andre Bush. See you here again next week.
Later.
Bye.